If you'd like to make a contribution, please put your hands up. Paddy.
Okay, well, I'll start things off then. Thanks for that, John. That was interesting. I think a lot of us are quite interested in this sort of subject, actually. You know, the sort of practical side of socialism. So, you know, and what could be done. Just a couple of things that I noticed that I thought that you were talking about heat pumps. I mean, I looked into this because you know they're banning gas boilers by I think 2035, so everybody's kind of sort of panicking what they're going to do when the boiler's you know past its useful life. But heat pumps seem to me one of the worst solutions. I mean, the kind that you were talking about was geothermal heat pumps, but they're between 13 and 18,000 pounds, and the cheaper ones that most people will. Even the cheap ones are £8,000. I mean, a gas boiler is about sort of 2,500, £3,000. So to give you some sort of context, but the cheaper air pumps that people could afford are air sourced. In other words, they extract heat from the ambient outside air. Well, the problem with that is if it's freezing outside, which in a lot of parts of Britain it is during winter, you know, then there isn't any heat to extract, so they're not really going to work. And plus, they're really slow as well, so you can be sat there freezing for 2 hours while the heat pump sort of slowly gets to work. I think because of that, in some areas of the country, there are experiments with hydrogen boilers. But there are two problems with that. One is that we don't have a hydrogen infrastructure for a start, and the other one is that most, something like 90-95% of hydrogen isn't green in the first place. It's extracted from fossil fuels. It's known as blue hydrogen. So that's the problem with hydrogen boilers. My favourite that I discovered is my current hot tip. Microwave boilers, which sounds very improbable, but it's the same size as a gas boiler. It goes in the same, it fits in the same place and fits onto the same pipes, and it costs about the same in energy as a gas boiler, but it uses electricity, obviously, which in this country I think something like 40 to 60% is renewable at any given moment. The only problem with them is there's only one company making them in this country at the moment. But I think that microwave boilers might be the way to go in the future. And just one other point while I'm on, you mentioned growing your own food. I mean, I sort of looked into that as well, but again, climate is somewhat against us in many parts of this country anyway. We just don't get the sun for long enough. But one thing that did occur to me is, I don't know about where other people live, but where I live, there's an awful lot of, it's all terraced houses, old terraced houses, and they've all got kitchen extensions, pretty much all of them, in the backyards with big flat roofs. Now, all those flat roofs get sun all the day, every single day. Whatever sun there is, those flat roofs get them. And they're all sort of, you know, perfectly feasible to turn them into rooftop gardens. Nobody's done it yet, and I suspect in capitalism it's never going to happen. In my area, if that happened, well, to be honest, I think they'd probably get vandalised. So that doesn't seem very likely that that's going to happen now. But, I mean, certainly in urban settings in socialism, rooftop gardens and sort of flat rooftop extensions to sloping roofs and that sort of thing could probably easily be done. So it's high up, it gets all the sun, it's away from pests, apart from birds. Very doable, I think. There's a lot of ways, because I think one of the things socialism will be doing, and I'm rambling a bit, but socialism will be looking at sort of local production rather than long supply chains, especially international sort of, you know, marine traffic and stuff. We've been trying to reduce that. So you want to look at producing as much as you could locally, and you know, little dodges like this would help out quite a lot. Okay, that's enough. Thanks.
Well, I'll take Andrew Davis next.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Go on, Andrew.
Oh, hi. Thanks, John. That was a very informative talk, and I'm sure everybody's really sort of, you know, learned something new from some of that. I'm sort of agreeing with Paddy, really, in this. I for my sins, my Catholic sins of old, I subscribe to the Daily Telegraph. But just to balance that out, I also have a sort of a pound a month or something for The Guardian. And the heat pump sort of debate has been going on for the last, well, I suppose about a year or so. And not only that, then, of course, when I'm driving around in my little car, I sometimes hear Evan Davis on the... what program is that? It's Radio 4, the PM. I think it's called PM. Yeah. And there's been a sort of a discussion about heat pumps on that. Now, it would seem as though The Guardian and the BBC are sort of all sort of keen on the heat pumps. You know, Evan Davis is always enthusiastic about everything anyway. Mm. But funnily enough, the Telegraph... which is the sort of, you know, right wing paper for rich people generally, you know, that's how they sort of present it. They're really down on it. There's been all these sort of articles about how you can't heat your farmhouse with a heat pump, and you know, they're fairly hopeless basically. I've followed it because I live in an old house. My house was built, well, not old compared to people who have lots of money, but my house was built in the 1930s, and it's really very drafty. And I've lived here for 20 years now, and I love my little house. It's great. It's a little sort of, it's my haven, really. But it is quite drafty. And I've got a gas boiler, and I'm thinking, oh, well, what will I do? You know, what could be better? You know, actually, I don't think there is much that could be better. I mean, I stick on these sort of oil-filled plug-in radiators as well to help out, you know, when it gets very cold. I think, you know, Paddy's sort of points and John's points were very, you know, well made, really. You know, in this country, in the UK, you know, and I would say most of Western Europe probably, the housing stock isn't brilliant, and insulation and so on, and ways of keeping our houses sort of as cozy as possible have not really been built into the system. Before I kind of go on any further, I think that's probably all I was going to say, really. But what I was really pleased with was that we weren't sort of going on. Yes. Before I go on to that next little bit, the other thing was that I've got a note for myself here. Start tomatoes and start courgettes on the back window over this weekend. The idea of just sort of, you know, growing our own is, I'm not sure we could feed a society that way. Not in the modern world, really, even after socialism. But it's good for you anyway to do it. So I'm all in favour of that. Thing that I would say, sorry, Chair, can I just say one more thing, is that we really do need to dance forward with technology. In every which way, when we talk about socialism as a practical alternative, technology is the answer to these problems. That's all I would want to say. Thanks ever so much for your patience. Thank you.
Right, thanks, Andy. John, I'll take Freddie next.
Okay.
And then go back to you. Go ahead, Freddie, please.
Yeah. Hi, John. Hope everyone's okay with you. It's just, one point I'd like to make is the point was made about the allotment. I thought was very, very valid. I know I've certainly mentioned on here before, not on Zoom, but certainly when it's been on Discord, that I do have an allotment which brings a great deal of joy in occasions. And whilst it's certainly true what Paddy says, the climate's not always with us, I haven't found a hindrance in terms of growing produce to quite a large extent throughout the year. And certainly a lot of the produce that can be produced can be stored fairly well. So, okay, whilst you might not be able to grow grapes and such like in an allotment, unless you've got a greenhouse or something like that, which I do have, but I don't bother growing grapes. I would certainly say that allotments can be quite fulfilling. And the people that you meet on allotments, are pretty good for sharing with each other, communicating with each other, giving each other assistance and a hand and such like. So, whilst Paddy certainly makes a fair point that it's not conducive to everything, having an allotment, our climate here, I'd recommend it to anyone that has, even if it's the back garden or whatever, that you can grow your own carrots or cauliflowers or whatever it might be, to go ahead and do so. So I would just like to make that point that I would certainly advocate allotments are a good idea, and fairly cheap to run, and far tastier the food that you get than what you get out of supermarkets at times. But the question, John, was when you were talking about solar panels, I didn't just sort of quite catch up or make out correctly, I think, what you were saying about solar panels, because I would have thought that solar panels would probably be a good idea. Of course, again, our climate might not be the best for it, but certainly where I live, I can see people getting more and more solar panels put on the roof. So there must be some advantages to it. So I was just wondering what it was you were saying about solar panels in particular, if you could tell us, please. Thanks.
Yes, the question of solar panels really is that for a long time, as with most products, the product hasn't been quite as good as the manufacturer would claim. I've found that in the course of my work, buying a lot of products, some of which have been powered by solar cells. So what we have found with small equipment that's out in the cold, in the Scottish climate, there really isn't sufficient sunlight for some of the cheap and nasty solar panels that we've used in the past and that we still have out there. But the kind of solar panels that are available now for people to put on their roofs are much better. And I see them dotted about all over the place. And I don't think all these people have been conned into buying it. I don't have them myself because the problem with those sites on the internet that suck you in and suck all the information out of you to give you nothing in return kind of puts me off a bit. I really need to spend more time investigating, as usual with capitalism, the cost of these things. And also, am I going to live long enough to reap the benefits of those costs? Now, some people that are significantly younger, if they buy solar panels, they can afford to wait another 30 years to get the benefit. Now, it might not be 30 years, but I seem to remember it being of the nature of about 20 or 30 years in the past. But I think that was with the inferior solar panels that they had whenever that was. So I think they have improved a lot in recent times. To what extent, I'm not sure. I couldn't really quantify it. But a lot of people are using them, and they seem to be able to save money on their electricity bills, which is quite an important thing at the present time. But one of the snags that seems to arise quite a lot is that when people go to try and sell energy back to Scottish Power, for example, they find themselves in difficulties or if not in difficulties, they just get such a miserly rate for their excess electricity that it's hardly worth the bother, or it's not as good as they were originally led to believe. But that seems to be the way of everything in capitalism. Nothing's as good as they tell you it will be. And that's one of the problems with capitalism. A lot of things that they know we should do, like they're talking about not having gas boilers and things like that, but the government's in a mess over it. They can't make up their mind how they want to subsidise it, or whether they do in fact want to subsidise it. And you see that with so many things. They just start some scheme up, and then before you know it, that's changed again. And it's as if somebody was just throwing a spanner in the works.
Right. I mean, that just about sums up capitalist politics, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Nobody's got their hand up. So I'd just like to widen it a little bit, because if we're talking about sustainability, the one thing about a socialist society is that we won't be producing anything that's related to the exchange system. So there won't be any cash machines, there won't be any tills, anything like that. There won't be all that sort of effort wasted, that this is social labour that's an absolutely pointless waste of our lives and the natural resources. I mean, I don't know, it'd be impossible to quantify, but how many people are doing absolutely pointless work, either operating the money system in itself, or creating machinery for it, and it's quite a sizable thing. Then you've got all of the industries which are there to defend private property, such as the war industry. Again, absolutely dreadful waste of resources, real waste of resources, and a diversion of resources when you think of the skills that these people learn that could be useful for civil defence activities. Right, I'll shut up and I'll let Comrade McEwen in. Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
All good. Right, I'm sorry, John, I missed your talk, because I love to hear the sound of your voice. But there's just something about your voice that's just so pristine.
Oh, well, thank you.
Is that it? Was that it, Paula? It appears so. Adam?
I think nobody's yet made the obvious point that in socialism, people don't need to be living in their own house with their own garden and having to get their own heat pumps or solar panels or windmills or whatever. Surely there'll be more, district heating or something like that. I think, which exists also under capitalism in places like Iceland and Finland. Houses and streets and whole areas are heated by hot water, which is generated one way or another. So it's a bit odd that we've been discussing what we could do as individual house owners to try and maintain sustainability. Somebody must know about these, district heating and things like that, which sound better than doing it, house by house. And the same with allotments. I mean, an individual can get a pleasure out of allotment, but I mean, it would be better if there was one big field that everybody wants, or something like that.
Yeah. Yes, it's something I meant to actually mention, was because it's something I've thought about quite a lot in the past, which is that I think people would live in larger groups. A bit like if you remember the book News from Nowhere, I think the guy who fell asleep and wakened up in socialism, he met these people that lived in much, much larger sort of building than most people would live in, and there's quite a significant number of them. They were a kind of community. And I would imagine families being much bigger, either composed of extended actual families or just groups of people that chose to live with each other. And in those circumstances, you would have the potential to build real eco-friendly houses, buildings that would be designed with, I say, the environment in mind, be designed with energy efficiency in mind and people's comfort, of course, in mind. And there would also be developments towards introducing more greenery into the urban setting. So we would lessen the distinction between town and country. And we would be able to develop to some extent anyway. We would need to see how that pans out. But to some extent, we would be able to develop more areas such as allotments, what are called allotments today, but we could become small farms within cities and towns. So a lot of that development could take place, but it can only take place once we have socialism, because within this society, we're very limited in what we can do. And as I mentioned earlier, if you live in places where you can get permission to do certain things, because you need permission for things that seem quite harmless in this society, you need some bureaucrat to just make sure that what criteria they often use. Sometimes it seems to be pure prejudice, but you know what I mean about capitalism. So you really do require the change in society before we can implement a lot of these wider and more effective changes.
And Andrew?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying this because, first of all, I'm just speaking very personally here, really. I'm a grower. You know, I grow onions, potatoes, courgettes, peppers, all sorts of things. I've only got a small plot, really. I mean, I've got a relatively small house, but I've got quite a lot of green space around it, which is fenced in, on my little plot, and so I'm really looking forward to the coming sort of season now, where I can do things. And I've got a couple of polytunnels as well out there as well. So it's great. But, we shouldn't sort of lose sight of the fact that sort of thing is quite sort of, I don't know if my onions or potatoes will come up this year or whatever, how they'll do, whatever. It's sort of done for pleasure and for leisure, really, and for relaxation. But what John alluded to earlier, about the way that, a socialist society can be planned, so that things are more, and I use the word very advisedly, but I think it's a good one, really, is that things, for the best quality of life, most people would want to live in sort of semi-rural or suburban type environments rather than incredibly built up sort of fractious city environments. But then some people might want to do that as well. And that should be something that might happen as well, but the other thing is that we have to think about this as a worldwide sort of thing, and who knows how things would develop across other sort of parts of the world where the climate is different and people's sort of cultural instincts are different and et cetera. The only thing I would really always push really for us as an organisation and to be saying in our public sort of synthesis of our thinking and so on is let's not be too kind of backward and too back to nature. technology has a lot to open up for agriculture, for feeding everybody in the world. And that's a really important thing to do as well. I think there's a bit of a, you know, a tendency for, I've written it down before John even gave his talk, you know, and it's just something I can't sort of be at one of these sort of meetings without saying something that is going to get me into trouble. And this is that, you know, I think there's a tendency that the 1970s intake in the party has essentially given a kind of a too much of a hippie sort of approach to the politics of the SPGB. And, you know, we need to be mindful of that, really. And, you know, long-haired boys are not always right. So that's all I'll say now before I get shot down in flames. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Right, thanks. It's a pity don't give us any details, but never mind, you can come back with that in a bit. Paula, if you'd like to go next then, please.
Oh, I think I got quite short before.
sorry, I thought you'd finished.
No, I was just about to get started.
I do apologise. It's just that you went really quiet. I thought you'd go make a cup of tea. All right, go ahead, please. Okay. I do apologise if you think I didn't do it deliberately. I thought I finished.
Okay, right. So I don't know. I mean, the thing is, right, I'm sorry I missed John's talk. I really am, and I've just come in late to this discussion about sustainability. And there's just two things I wanted to say. The first is that I live in a really, you know, a Victorian house. You know, but it's really strongly built, you know what I mean? And I think that's the thing about the Victoria, you know, about, I don't know, the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, they built things to last, didn't they? You know, the sewers and the houses and the railway and the tunnels and all the rest of it. Whereas nowadays, everything's just built really, really cheaply. So that houses that were built 20 years ago or 30 years ago now get demolished because they're no longer sustainable. Anyway, that was just my point about the Victorian thing. Even though I live in a house that's maybe, you know, it does get a bit damp now and again, but I think in the long term it could probably last another 100 years.
You've just gone inaudible.
Oh, sorry.
That's
can
better,
you hear me?
That's it. Got you now.
Okay. Yeah. So the other point I wanted to make was actually about how crap it is to live in Britain compared to other European countries. Right. So I don't think we can't think of ourselves in Britain as somehow being, you know, state of the art, you know, workers. Or state of the art, you know, how things are. So I was reading this column today in The Guardian from John Crace, and he was comparing ourselves with Germany. Right, average wages in Germany are £43,500. In the UK, they're £26,200. In Germany, the state pension is 70% of your final salary. In the UK, it's 9,627. And then there's the rental market. So a one-bed flat is 34% of your salary. In Germany, it's 18%. You know, it just goes on like this, just comparing us with this other, you know, modern, you know, capitalist economy. And I just think, and then you look at France, right? You look at what's happening in Paris. You know, about how they're all, you know, the workers are really, really angry about the raising of the state pension age. And we've got a state pension age where we're basically, we're going to be dead before we get our pension. And there's no, you know, there's no revolt, there's no revolution, there's nothing about that. We just accept it somehow. And I just think, you know, we're the Socialist Party. And, you know, we're a revolutionary party, and yet we exist in a country where we're actually quite backward as far as working class conditions are concerned. Okay, I may have gone off topic there, but I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
That's in fact something I was thinking about earlier today, is this whole business in France and how the workers there have organised to thwart this this increase from the age 62 to, I mean, from our vantage point, we're saying, oh, they're only moving it up to 64, because we're used to the government being really sleeked and saying, well, we're moving it up to 66. And then over the next few years, we expect to sneak it up to about 68 or 69. And to try and restore what to them is the status quo ante, where we did all die before we got the pension, or at least died after a decent short interval after receiving it. You would tend to get, with men, they tended to be able to retire at 65 and tended to be dead by the time they were 67. With women, it was a bit anomalous, which is why they've increased their lifetime of wage slavery savagely, because they used to be able to retire at 60, and you found that women lived quite a long life after that. So they want to obviously correct that and have men and women dying pretty soon after they collect a pension, because they don't really want wage slaves that are not producing surplus value anymore, notwithstanding the fact that the pension that you're getting is only deferred wages. But they don't care about that. They want as much as they can get, which is why they raid workers' pension funds as well. But that's another matter. We are going off maybe topic a bit.
Okay, I think it's it's either Joy or Howard next.
It's Howard, Steve.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that very good point, Paula. Very good point indeed, and it sort of ties in with what an old member of my branch used to say. He used to say, "We will not get socialism until capitalism has given us more." Until people have got sort of time and space to think about a different kind of society, even if this one is actually, you know, gradually improving our living standards. And there's an irony here that you know, as Paula says, the Socialist Party, you've got a Socialist Party of Great Britain, which advocates what we advocate. There isn't a similar party in Germany or France. You'd think there might be. Okay, we've had members, we've had sympathisers, but you know, it's an interesting point. It's a thing worth thinking about. The fact that you know, our idea has, you know, to a very limited extent caught on here, very limited extent indeed, but you know, to a much smaller extent in countries where capitalism is actually giving workers more, giving them a bit more space, giving them sort of slightly more than they've got in this country. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting topic, that.
As nobody else has got their hands up, I was going to jump in. I just wondering what Andrew was saying before about being a grower of his own food and stuff like that. It just... By purely coincidence, the capital reading group that I'm running, we're just up to chapter 15 of volume one, and the stress that Marx puts on the role of machinery in the capitalist production system is one that degrades entirely the human being, that makes us the appendage to the machine, a bit like Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times. It is intended and actively does develop one or two skills rather than developing rounded human beings. We're not grown for that in this society. We're grown to be human resources that are dominated by the machine. And the good thing about a socialist society will be that we will be allowed to, we'll have the option of developing as many skills as we possibly can, whilst we're still obviously all going to have to contribute towards society's production. Well, yeah, it's just occurred to me there as you were talking about me, you're obviously a more rounded human being, Andy, than anybody else. If you grow your own food, as does Freddie, of course. We finally discovered why you keep your cap on, because you've got a drafty house. All right, do you want to go ahead and make your contribution now?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, Chair, first of all, may I ask subtly and most comradely, were you sort of slightly taking the piss there with your sort of left remark? It doesn't matter if not.
It's a Friday night. No, not at all. If you're growing stuff, no, I mean it. That's the type of thing that we ought to look up to. As a more rounded human being. Honestly, I wasn't taking them back.
You're joking, aren't you?
No.
No,
when I take the piss, you'll know.
Okay, all right then. Oh, I'll take that as a compliment then. That's fabulous. Thank you very much indeed. With regard to chapter 15 in volume one, Marx was talking about the way that we are, as human beings, alienated from the product of our labour. Which obviously then feeds, or moves towards the sort of the theory of, Marxism and alienation, the way that we have no control over our social relationship to the commodities that we are forced to, we have to have, as part of our survival, really. What was I going to say on that? Oh, I think I've forgotten now. I was having far too much of a good time thinking you were pulling my leg. I'll leave it at that then. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry, I put you off.
On the subject of alienation, I heard a funny story from New York. I don't know how true it is or whether it's just one of these apocryphal things, but apparently there was a woman on the tube who told this guy opposite her to stop smiling at her. And his response was, "I wasn't smiling at you. I was smiling at your dog. I would never smile at a person." And I thought, as well as being quite funny, I thought that really illustrates how alienated people have become, because people on trains and things do everything but look at the person next to them or opposite them and look up at signs up above them, particularly on the tube, and read them and reread them. Yet they still don't know what the advert said, but they've reread it several times, but they're desperate not to be seen looking too closely at any of the other people that they're sharing the train with. So that's certainly an example of alienation.
If I could just make another point, John, about the way in which socialism will be a far more sustainable society. The capitalist class is forced into looking for more and more markets, throwing more and more junk at us. I was in the pub last night watching a game of football, and in halfway through, half time, there's these adverts on for city breaks, fly to Prague, fly to Reykjavik, stuff like that. I'm thinking, hang on, why does it suddenly become necessary for us to do that? But I mean, that's just an example. But we are faced with this barrage of junk being suggested to us that this is the way that you should. These are important things. We've now got retail therapy. Make yourself feel a little bit better by going buying something new, which is a complete absurdity because it doesn't make you feel any better after about 4 minutes. And then what it's going to do, you can more or less bet your life that it's going to fall apart in another 25 minutes. So we're being sold junk that we don't need and junk that is going to fall apart rather than, as Paula was suggesting, stuff that was well made. By the way, I grew up in a house built in Victorian times. It got knocked down in 1971 because it was a slum. And I think if you look at the slum housing that the mill owners threw up around here, round the mills, they were just absolutely appalling, scabby little hovels. So that's my recollection of growing up in a textile town, rather than stuff being well built. It was absolutely scummy. Right, I'll take Pat next then, please.
Right, hello. I felt that I had to make a contribution, Steve, just to show off that I hope that I'm equipped now so that I can be heard this evening. But the idea of people, as people do now, sort of growing things and growing food in their own garden, but it put me in mind of in my early days in the party, hearing people referred to as the simple lifers in a critical way. But of course, we actually can't feed the world with everyone just growing their own food. And I know that isn't what was intended from what people were saying earlier. Obviously, some things will have to be grown on a larger scale. And now you have, I have relatives who bake their own bread because they get a better quality. Well, presumably, when things are really into a different kind of society, there won't be the same concerns about quality because things will grow, as with all things, at the best that's needed to be done, the best, you know, quality that is needed. And of course, gardening and growing things is one of the really most sort of satisfactory things that you can do. It's really to be outside, and I've certainly found that doing some gardening when the weather's suitable is really really helpful to feel better about things. But that's about it, really. I just, as I say, wanted to make a small contribution because I should be able to be heard without any problem. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Pat. John, do you want to come back or shall we get Dougie in? Dougie?
No, just go to Dougie. That was interesting to hear.
I mean, sustainability is an interesting subject when you think about the world, not just Britain, right here. I mean, just in Britain, if you're standing waiting on a bus, you see so many people in cars and just one person driving cars, and you know, a lot of that's just simply not sustainable. Not everybody can't have a car, right here. You should have a proper, you know, a proper bus system or tram system or whatever. Well, when I go to Holland, you know, a lot of people ride bikes in Holland, you know, and they have brilliant tram system in The Hague, where I go, and also in Amsterdam and things. I did see a thing, you know, the trains generate electricity that is used in other ways, right? You know, so, you know, just it's quite clever, really, the way they do it in Holland and Drouin, you know. I did see a thing once where you could maybe extract CO2 out of the atmosphere on trains or whatever, you know, if you have the right capture system or whatever. But I mean, just talking about sustainability, I mean, not everybody can have the standard of living that they have in European countries worldwide, really, you know, because the planet's just not capable of doing that, really, you know. So, I mean, well, I have to think seriously about things, really, you know. And also, I mean, look at what's happened in Turkey with the earthquake, really, you know. They build those buildings that aren't earthquake-proof or whatever, you know. And, you know, thousands of people die because it's cheaper to put up shoddy buildings than make them the same way they make them in New Zealand or California or whatever, that can withstand earthquakes. And obviously, people don't die when they have an earthquake. So, well, not many anyway. Not like Turkey or whatever. So there's all sorts of things with sustainability. But I'm just not sure how things go, because a lot of people live in shanty towns and things. I mean, Steve talked about slums in the Industrial Revolution here. There's a lot of places where people are living in shanty towns, you know, just corrugated iron or whatever, you know. So, I mean, giving people proper homes is going to be a priority when we get socialism. And I don't know, I'm rambling a bit, but that's all I wanted to say.
Right, do you want to come back, John? Excuse me, I'm losing my throat, losing my voice. John, do you want to come back on that? If you do, you're muted.
Sorry. No, not really. I think with respect to the standard of living that could be available, well, a lot of the standards of living that's referred to is quite often to do with the stuff of capitalism that they try to persuade us, like having a car. What we need is not to have a car necessarily, but to have access to a vehicle when we need to make a journey, or even better than that, not necessarily being stuck with the idea of a car as a vehicle, although I think there could be a hierarchy of means of travel, you know. So for big journeys, you could maybe take a train, and then for shorter journeys within an urban setting, you might have an electric vehicle, and you may pick one up from a point where, just as they did in Holland with bikes, you'd pick one up, use it, and then just leave it at your destination, and there would be some electronic means of detecting where all the vehicles that are available are. And if necessary, relevant people could come along and take the vehicles to places more suited to them being picked up and used by other people. There's all sorts of things that could be done in socialism. There wouldn't be any need to have anywhere near as many cars as there are today. It's just a complete and utter waste of resources. And if people expected to all have their own car, well, they're not going to be of the sort of standard that understands and desires socialism. They're going to be on some other wavelength of thinking. But I think that, you know, in socialism, people won't feel the need to have their own car parked outside their house. What they want is a vehicle as and when they need it to make a journey.
If I might just come in, the system that you're talking about there, John, about public vehicle, public small vehicles, that already exists. Renault have got a thing called Twizy, which they're using. I think they're using it in Madrid. I think in Paris and stuff like that. And you're quite right. The technology that you just described exists already. It's there, including this location the electronic location for stuff like that. So this isn't mental. This isn't some sort of dream that socialists have. This is actually available in capitalism. It's just that, of course, as we don't need to say it. It's just that there's a need for markets. There's a need for selling. There's a need to keep people atomized as consumers of every last possible imaginable gem that can be produced. Right, Andrew.
Okay, am I on? I'm not muted or whatever. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I just picked up a book that's on my shelf here, and it's one that I make reference to. I'm a bit of a bore about this, really, but I'll just put it over there. Some people might have seen it before at head office. It's over here. That's Yes Utopia by Ron Cook. And the point about that book is that Ron Cook, who was really my first contact in the Socialist Party back in, I don't know, 25 years or so, maybe even more than that now. But Ron was a sort of great mentor, and he became a great friend, really. And he would share with me sort of his sort of story of his life, really, you know, very fascinating person. But Ron, you know, talks about this idea about, you know, we have a pint of beer in the local pub where Ron lives, and he would say, we need to move away from this capricious anarchy into a system of conscious social control, you know. And he didn't put it quite as I can't sort of put across his way of speaking, really, in because he was a very gentle man, really. But this was what it was about. You know, it was taking this sort of anarchic system. I mean, I have to go out onto the roads every day because I manage a couple of care homes in Wolverhampton. I live in Walsall, which is only just down the road, you know. But goodness me, every morning when I'm trying to sort of negotiate in the traffic, it's a nightmare, really. And then just a couple of weeks ago, one of the cars I've got hit a wall and hit another car on the back end in the snow. And that's now getting written off. And they're going through all the insurance and everything, and they won't talk to me. They just sort of, you know, say, oh, you know, go through the email system and da-di-da or the website and whatever, you know. So, yeah, I mean, the cars, I'd happily live without a car as long as I can sort of go out and get something to take me from A to B from nearby, you know. I mean, I think most people would do that. But the point about it is that this has to be sort of available worldwide, you know, because, you know, we can only have socialism after the forces of production are at the point where this is possible. In my opinion, it is possible. The forces of production have developed the forces of material wealth for everybody to the extent that socialism is now possible, and we shouldn't really sort of put that off. What I should argue against, and I know this is something that I will really pee some people off with, is that, you know, we shouldn't be arguing that, you know, working class should expect less. It doesn't matter whether you're in the UK, whether you're in Canada, or whether you're in Africa or India or, you know, anywhere like that. It should just be like, you know, come on, guys, let's just sort this now. And that should be the focus for us. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Andy.
Yeah, I don't think we would ever wish to argue that people would have less. Plus the fact the forces of capitalism are such that there's no chance that people would have less. just about everyone would potentially have more, but it's just some things there's no point in having more of. I mean, in my day-to-day life, I don't feel the need for more and more stuff. What I feel the need for is secure access to some of that stuff that I need in order to live. But I don't feel the need to get more and more stuff. If I had, I mean, I do always feel that my wages are never quite enough, but I think that's conditioning from capitalism, because a lot of the stuff I do have, I don't need any more of, as I say. I'm able to eat reasonably well, but what I can't be sure of is always having access to that, is the insecurity. That's one of the major problems with capitalism, that you can have sufficient material goods. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, such as CDs, that at one time people would have needed to have to live in a castle and hire an orchestra for their party. And by the way, these people didn't sit meekly and quietly and listen to the music. They partied and sang and danced, and the music was there as background. But nowadays, we can get access, if it's that kind of classical music or whatever kind of music it is, we can all get access to it, and with a reasonable sort of sound system, we can all hear that music that at one time only was available to wealthy people. So even without owning it, because I'm a bit out of date talking about CDs, I realise that. I mean, you could just store that on a drive on your computer, or as a lot of people do, is just seek it out from the internet as and when they want to listen to it. Although with the hostile forces that have already taken over the internet, like i.e. the capitalist class and their agents, you'll soon find that a lot of stuff that you want is going to cost you more and more.
Well, John, if I might interrupt you, I'm sorry I didn't go through the chair, but, you know, things like this Alexa, the Alexa? I've got one over here. Alexa, say hello to John Cumming.
Hello, John Cumming.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
That's the first time I've heard Alexa for real.
Me too. That's brilliant. Good. I'll tell you what was. Excuse me for interrupting. Could you ask Alexa what's the rate of exploitation? What determines the rate of exploitation?
Yeah. Alexa, what determines the rate of exploitation of workers?
Sorry, I'm not sure.
There you go. Okay, right.
A diplomatic answer. I'm not sure.
Can I take Paula next then?
Yeah, it's just on the subject of transport in socialism and also sustainability and quality of life. And what I think is when we've got a socialist society, we'll all be riding horses again. That's my favourite means of transport. If I have to go from here to 3 miles away, 5 miles away, I'd like to go on a horse. I don't want to go on a train. I don't want to go on a tram. I just want to go on a horse. Let's bring them back. That's what I say.
Right, well, you'd be as fast on a horse these days in London as you would in a car. I'll take Mike Foster next, please. What's your preferred form of transport, Mike?
I'm quite attached to my car, and I do like the sense that it's my zone, you know, sort of my place where I can play my Brian Ferry albums on my CD player to my heart's content. So yeah, I'm quite possessive about my car. Yeah, maybe that's something I need to think about a bit more. But my point was sort of about that, really. About, you know, the sort of the carpool scenario, and sort of living in a more and travelling in a more sustainable way that way. And I suppose sort of playing devil's advocate, that, you know, there's a chance that might be imposed on us within capitalism or something similar, if if there is some sort of energy crisis in terms of powering cars, or due to the damage to the environment, things start to get rationed a bit more, and things like carpools might be imposed on us as a form of rationing under capitalism, rather than being chosen voluntarily in a socialist society. And I suppose thinking of that, that reminds me that, a socialist society is going to have to inherit whatever damage to the environment has been caused by capitalism. And we know that, that's not really heading in a very optimistic direction at the moment. So, any sustainability won't just be for its own sake, but it'll also be to sort of mitigate a lot of damage already being done. And that'll have to be a practical consideration for people around at the time. So, I suppose, my point was just that, that environmental concerns are a big part of the decision-making process over sustainability. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, Andy, do you want to come back in?
Yeah, Mike's point is very, very pertinent. Do you still live around the Birmingham area, Mike?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm just making a little point, really, from personal experience. I worked in King's Heath and Moseley for a number of years until a couple of years ago. I packed that up and I moved over to Wolverhampton. I didn't move house, but I moved my job situation over to Wolverhampton, because the Birmingham City Council are essentially making it impossible for ordinary people to drive through the city to get from one side of it to the other side of it now in a car. They wanted to charge me £12 a day to do that, and I think the point you just made about, this kind of pricing people off the road is quite pertinent, really. I mean, at the end of the day, working class people have to make their living. And so if there's a care home in King's Heath that needs a manager, then I could do that. But I'm not going to do it if I'm going to have, a significant sort of charge every week, just at the whim of the local council, because they want to raise funds, which aren't anything to do with the environment at all. So, nonsense. And likewise, these sort of charging schemes, I think everybody in London who are far more sort of ahead of us are already very well used to anyway. So the point about London is, though, and I take Paula's comments really, on board there, is that the Victorians planned the city quite well, and so all the tubes and everything work extremely well. But Birmingham's a nightmare. So I don't go there anymore.
Thanks, Andy. Well, comrades, it's 20 past nine. I wonder, does anybody that hasn't spoken yet want to make a contribution? Or should I ask John if he wants to give us a bit of a wind-up? I'll do the latter then. John, do you want to just have a quick summary? Or even a new idea, don't know.
Yes, just to respond to something Andy said about the difficulty that happens in quite a lot of cities now, because they're all trying in various ways to at least appear to be eco-friendly, they're failing miserably at it, but they're very unimaginative. Glasgow's a city that's very difficult to, for decades now, I've never attempted, by and large, to drive into the city centre. I usually find a way to circumvent it. Really, a lot of this has arisen. All this car usage in my lifetime, there were fewer people had cars. And a lot of this increase in car usage has actually come at the behest of the capitalist class, because they've sought people for various jobs further and further afield. I can remember when most people could walk to their work. But now, well, where I was working before I became a remote worker and was allowed to work from home, I had to drive. And the only way to get there was by car, because to successfully arrive where I was going for my work, I would have to travel back towards Glasgow and then back out from Glasgow by public transport. It was just ridiculous if I were to try and use public transport. So I was forced into having a car again. And many people are in that position. And many people have only got a car because they felt forced to look further and further afield for work, work that's only for the benefit of, as we know, the capitalist class. So a lot of these things are of the capitalist class's own making. And then, of course, they punish us later on when they discover, oh, this is not good. We need to do something about this. And it probably is a good thing to try and control the flow of vehicles through cities. But it's just done so incoherently. And they don't make better transport, public transport available. I just expect people to somehow be willing to endure lengthier and lengthier days just because they've suddenly become, as they see it, eco-friendly. But in actual fact, they're not eco-friendly and they're certainly not worker-friendly. So that's all I would say on that point. And just thanks to everybody else who was listening and had something to say. Whether you were listening and had something to say or not, it doesn't matter. All who were listening and all who had something to say, thank you very much.
Right. Thanks a lot, John. So we've not got a meeting next week. Adam, can we just check when our next meeting is?
It's on the 14th of April, because there's no meeting next week.